Thousands of children
vinieron a dar.
They brought a lot of joy to the house.
Are waiting for a temporary home.
Y aquí está.
Here we are, 6 years.
But in Milwaukee County, there's a disconnect.
About 15% of kids in care are Hispanic and Latino.
That could rob some children of their culture.
That connection with that community that they are from is very important for kids.
This week on Open Record, how Wisconsin's largest foster care agency
it said if you wanted to be a hero, that there were many Latino kids entering the foster system.
Is bridging the gap of a language mismatch. From the Fox 6 studios, this is Open Record. I'm your host, Brian Polson, and I'm joined by Open Record's executive producer, Sarah Smith. Hey, Sarah.
Hi.
We are also joined for his maiden voyage in Open Record by Fox 6 reporter Durante Matthews. Welcome to Open Record, Durante.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And we have a special guest joining us via Zoom this week. She recruits foster parents for Children's Wisconsin. Her name is Ashley Argall, and she is here. Welcome to Open Record, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you on. We are recording this episode on Wednesday, January 31st, for release on Thursday, February 1st. And this week, we're going to be talking about a mismatch in the foster care system and what Children's Wisconsin is doing about it. And we're going to get started when we come back after this. We are back. Durante, we've talked on Fox 6 before about the overall need for foster families, but last week you reported on one particular facet of this need that caught your attention. Tell us a little bit about how you got started on this story.
So many people may know, others may not know, that I originally came from Peoria, Illinois, reporting out there. And I was one of the only reporters out there who could speak Spanish. So I did a lot of stories with the Hispanic community out there. And that was something that I really wanted to carry over here in Milwaukee. So I just started researching on Facebook things that are affecting the Hispanic population, the Latino community. And then I came across this page from Children's Wisconsin that spoke about the need for bilingual foster families and the fact that there are more kids that speak Spanish in the system than there are foster parents. So that's kind of where I found the story, and then I just really delved into it. I reached out to Children's Wisconsin, and then, yeah, that's how it all came about.
So you started by going out looking for what's affecting this community, and this is one of the first things you found that you said, okay, this is something we need to talk about.
Exactly, because it's a story that I've never done before, and it's actually a story that I've never thought about before, which is sad. I know a lot of people don't really think about the foster care system, and specifically, you know, the minorities within the foster care system.
You know, I was thinking about this here. We are recording an English language podcast. So we're going to be talking about something that has a lot of interest and importance to a Spanish speaking community that here we are speaking in English. That strikes me as something right off the bat that sort of underscores this disconnect, right?
Exactly. And one of the things that I thought about this is not just a Latino story or a Hispanic story. Yes, it affects that community. However, it's really universal because at the center of it all is children. And that's sort of what we are, you know, focusing on. Yes, we're trying to pair them more. Well, the focus is pairing them more with people who can speak their language. But at the end of the day, it's all about them, you know, getting them connected and getting them into a loving home where they can communicate with people who understand them.
And in doing the story, you reach out to Children's Wisconsin, you end up talking to Ashley. Ashley, you specialize in recruiting foster families. What prompted this Spanish language post that caught Durante's attention in the first place?
Yeah, so as Durante was describing, there is that mismatch right now between the number of kids in care who speak Spanish and our foster families who are able to speak Spanish. And so as part of our recruitment efforts for spreading the word in the community as a whole about the need for foster parents, and then especially for Spanish-speaking foster parents, we've developed a website, and it's part of the Children's Wisconsin website, but it's particularly a page that's in Spanish with information about foster care, so that when people are interested and if they prefer reading information in Spanish, the information's there for them and they can reach out to us that way.
So, Ashley, I've been at Fox 6 for 16 plus years, and when I first started,
we had done a story, and I was part of a story that we looked into the foster care system and just kind of the need for foster families. And Children's Wisconsin played a part in helping us gather research and information. And obviously that need has not gone away. I assume it's greater, and obviously your resources need to go more that way as well.
Definitely. Yep. Yeah, so we've been serving kids in the community for many years. Children's has had the child well-being and foster care programs. And over time, we're just continually kind of developing, listening to what the needs are in the community and trying to meet those needs. So prior to this, we would, when families reached out who spoke Spanish, I would do a lot of talking with families one-on-one. We had like an initial email with general information in Spanish and an information packet and things in Spanish. But it's really nice to have this resource online that's a website, especially with technology like continuing to develop all the time nowadays. We can give it to people with a QR code, have it on posters in the community and things like that to just be able to continue spreading the word.
So Ashley, tell me, because I always talk about how I love this podcast and I love this job because I learn about things I never knew anything about, or I knew very little about the foster care system itself. I want to step back. Can you just tell us who is in foster care? Who is foster care for to begin with?
That's a great question. So it is kids in our community who have experienced either abuse or neglect. And that abuse can encompass a lot of different things, but typically it's some form of physical, sexual, emotional, or verbal abuse. And kids come into care through the county. So when a report is made for a child's safety, as a lot of people might be somewhat aware of, whether through a teacher or another adult in a child's life, it's the county Child Protective Services who responds to that call, kind of looks at the situation and decides if a child can receive support within the home for that situation. Or if there is like an immediate, if a child's in immediate danger, then they'll make that decision for the child to have to leave their home and come into foster care. That's when Children's then receives a call from the county that there is a child who is needing a temporary home. And then we will reach out to the families that are licensed through Children's and work to make sure that child has a place to stay.
So you brought up licensed families, and those, that's an important word, licensed. So what does it take to be a foster parent or a foster family? And then what are some of the qualifications that Children's Wisconsin specifically looks for in families to be foster?
It's another great question. So some of the basic requirements are just being at least 21 years old. So there isn't an upper age limit to being a foster parent. And then you can be in any relationship. So a common myth sometimes is that you have to be married. But you can be single, married, partnered, dating, any healthy relationship status is welcome. And then you also don't have to own your own home. You can be renting or own your home as long as you have at least two bedrooms in your home, or actually at least one bedroom in your home where adults don't stay. Kids in foster care can share a room with other kids. They just can't share a room with adults. And then you also, there is a financial requirement. Foster care isn't a job. You don't make money being a foster parent, so you do have to have a form of income already. As long as it's documented as a form of income, it can count. So things like SSI or Social Security are included in that too, or any other job or form of income you might have.
For those who are listening, though, and they think, okay, but I'm already strapped. I don't have the ability to pay for something like this. Is there financial assistance that helps with this process?
There is. So you will get a small stipend as a foster parent. It's not a lot of money. Many foster parents say that you might still have to contribute some of your money, but it at least is something that can support with some of those costs that come with raising kids, covering food, clothing, things like that.
Is there a chance to, so if you're a foster family, a foster parent, is there the ability, the chance to end up adopting the child or children you take into your home?
It can happen. So the goal is always reunification for all the kids when they first come into care. And while a child is in foster care, there will be court hearings that will take place with the child's family. And in that very first court hearing, the judge will kind of put forth a list of things that the child's birth family will have to complete in order for that child to be able to return home. And so then while the child's in care, that family will be receiving support on the back end with social workers and different things to work toward meeting the goals on that list. And the longer that the child is in care, that will all be taking place. And so if that does take place, a child will be able to reunify. It's about 62% of cases when kids are able to reunify. So it's about 38% of cases when kids are unfortunately not able to reunify. And then in those cases, typically the foster family, you'd be the first family asked if you'd be open to adoption, just to maintain that permanency for kids.
I'm assuming this is a big topic during that training process, the licensing process, but do some foster parents come into this, or people coming into it being prospective foster parents, hoping for adoption and have to sort of accept the reality that in most cases, that's not where this is going and that's not the intention. The intention is ultimately reunification, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. So there's two ways to adopt in Wisconsin. There's private adoption agencies, which work a little bit differently, where it's usually a pregnant mother who's choosing adoption for her child. And so that can sometimes be a more direct route to adoption. So that is an option out there. Or there is the option of foster care. And so we kind of talk to families about both options and the pros and cons with both. But foster care is very needed. And so when we have people who are maybe saying that their ultimate goal is adoption, we say, like, you know, this is the situation for kids in our community. You know, are you open to supporting kids' families too? And a lot of times when people think about it, they are open to supporting that reunification in general. And then we usually say that the longer that you foster, you will very likely be able to adopt at some point. It's just really hard to say how it would look. And then, as you said, that goal is reunification in the beginning.
So we know that there is a huge challenge in just recruiting foster parents in general. Obviously, the purpose of this story, Durante, was to talk about this mismatch in terms of the language barrier. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about why that exists and what's being done to try to bridge that gap. We'll do that when we come back. So, Durante, when you start looking at this story, one of the things you reported was a statistical mismatch here. This was a difference between the number of foster families or the percentage that are Spanish speaking, or I'm sorry, the number of children in need of this care who speak Spanish or who are Hispanic or Latino, and then the number of families available. What did you find?
So I found out that specifically in Milwaukee County, there are about 1,800 kids in the foster care system. And in that 1,800, about 13% of the kids identify as Hispanic or Latino. And there's about 7% of foster parents who identify as the same Hispanic or Latino. So there is that gap there as far as matching them with people who identify the same or at least speak the same language.
Now, Ashley or Children set you up with, or I think that's how you got in contact with, there was a family who actually has done some of these adoptions. Can you talk a little about, I think it was Eva Hernandez?
Yes, Eva Hernandez and Ricardo Hernandez. And I actually saw their blog post on Children's website. So, Children's Wisconsin set me up with them. And what I actually found out is that their story actually started while Eva was cooking. She was in the kitchen. So she said that she and her husband, Ricardo, they could not become biological parents. So that was the first step. And then she had heard about fostering over the years, but it was nothing she really ever paid attention to until one day she was in the kitchen and then she heard an ad in Spanish. And then that was what really resonated with her. The ad, it said, "If you want to be a hero," and it was referring to, you know, fostering children, taking them out of a particularly traumatic situation and then giving them a loving home until, you know, they could possibly be reunited with their family or another side adoption. And that hearing it in her own language is what, you know, prompted her to talk to her husband about it. And then after that, they reached out to Children's Wisconsin. And 6 years later, they actually have four. They've fostered four kids and actually adopted three of them and in the process of adopting the fourth.
So what did you find when you went to the house? Like, I know we saw a video of being at the house. I mean, going from no children in the house to then kind of building on that, it's got to be a little bit bustling.
Definitely. I was telling them that they're kids because we went to interview them around, I want to say, 9 o'clock in the morning. And those kids had so much energy. It was crazy. And then I actually have a line in my story that this is a sound that they never thought that they'd hear because they couldn't become biological parents. And yeah, those kids were very energetic. The house was childproof like crazy. Some stuff I couldn't even open.
Ashley, we lost you for a minute. We got you back. So in seeing that experience, you see what a great experience it's been for that family and obviously for those kids. But back to the beginning of this, there's this disconnect. The percentage of children who identify as Hispanic or Latino and the number of foster families who identify that way. Why is there a difference and why is that so important to resolve?
Sometimes there can be fear, that becoming licensed is a lot of government paperwork and things like that. And so sometimes working within that system can cause fear. And so we're really trying to be out in the community and educating around that you'll have support throughout this whole process, that there might be a lot of paperwork, but you'll have a social worker with you. They're called a licensing worker that you can ask questions to as you're going through the licensing process. I think sometimes some of it is just awareness too. And so that's another piece where we're always working of new ways that we can, get out there, spread the word, through the news, and working with you guys is a route that, definitely has gotten a lot of attention. There's been a lot of families reaching out, since we've been out promoting and since the story with Durante too.
What I wondered about with this is there's many of these children may, because they're living in Wisconsin, they may well be bilingual. They can speak English. So it's not that they couldn't necessarily communicate with a foster family that speaks English. Why, if that's the case, why is it still important to find a family that also has that cultural background and that language background?
It's so important for kids as they're growing to have that connection with their heritage, community, culture, identity. Just as we all grow, it's a part of our identity that we're forming. And so also as kids are coming into care, it's already a lot of changes that kids go through. A new routine, maybe living in a new neighborhood, not having the same connections with people that were in their lives before. And so as kids are going through that process, anything that can be more comfortable and familiar to kids is also really important. And so having some of the same foods or even just same cultural practices and things like that is really helpful to kids during that time.
I know there's kids that come into the foster system are of different races, different ethnicities. Do you try to, you know, is there a consideration done to try to pair up kids of a certain race or ethnic background with families in similar situations?
It is taken into consideration, and it's something that is definitely always looked at when the placement call happens. A lot of times kids will, they might be in a sibling group or in a certain age range. And so as we're calling, those are all part of the conversations too with families. And so it's kind of all taken into consideration together. And it just depends on which families have open bedrooms in their home for placement at the time that kids come into care. But it's definitely a factor in mind.
I imagine it would be hard to always have a perfect match of, you know, we have just this number of, say, Jewish parents for Jewish children, or that, you know, this from people from this country or this part of Europe or whatever it might be. But it when it comes to Hispanic and Latino children, are you seeing a bigger gap there maybe than in any other areas?
It's about similar, actually, to other areas. And so really just in general, we're always looking to be in communities that kids are from, to be working to spread the word there about the need. And even location is a consideration too. So kids actually do stay in their same school when they come into foster care, okay, if they were already aged kindergarten or higher. And so part of that is to help kids with maintaining connections with the same friends, or the same like general neighborhood that kids used to be in. So that's also taken into consideration is location and how closely a foster family might live to a child's community that they're from.
If you had people watching right now that are on the fence or who have never considered this before, and they're hearing about this now and they're going, I don't know, is that something I could do? What's your elevator pitch to someone to say you really should consider becoming a foster parent or foster family?
I just speak to our foster parents who do it, and so many of them talk about just how much it has affected their lives for the better. And a common fear that sometimes foster parents will have is if they already have kids of their own at home, the uncertainty of if a child does reunify, if that will be difficult for their kids, and things like that. And so many of our foster parents say that even when a child has to reunify, even though it's painful, to have to say goodbye to someone who's been with you for maybe a year or a little more than a year, that it's so rewarding, could be a word, to know that you helped, you were part of the story as a family was working toward healing, and to see that reunification happen is just something that supports families and supports our community as a whole.
In your role at with Children's is recruitment. You're trying to get more people in to do this sort of thing. But I would imagine there are some foster families who've been doing this for a very long time, and they've been through, and they've been sort of the go-tos for a long time. Do you talk to them sometimes? And, you know, what are some of the reasons people stay in foster care for so long?
I think it's that. I think it's foster care is a calling. It takes selflessness, and it takes a commitment to the community, and a commitment to just really supporting families. And so if you're someone who's out there who is just passionate about children and then also supporting families in general, foster care might be for you. And our families who've done it for a long time, that's really their why, or they have a why that drives them. But it usually has something to do with that, with supporting kids and supporting families. And so even though foster care isn't always an easy system, when you keep your eye on that why and the purpose being for kids and their families, it helps as you're moving through the process.
We were talking, I think, or maybe emailing about this earlier, but Durante, you step in to do the story because you wanted to find something that would affect that community that was important. You do the story, you raise attention, and Ashley, I think you say that there's already been an impact from Durante's piece. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been seeing calls and inquiries come in since the story happened. So, yeah, we've had several, which is more than we would have on a typical day. So it's great to be able to be talking with people who are interested in learning more.
And when they inquire, obviously there's a whole process to go through to become a foster parent. We don't have to go into great detail about this, but what does that entail? I mean, my understanding is Children's Wisconsin is one of the only agencies, foster care agencies in the state, that offers all of these trainings in both English and Spanish.
Correct. Yeah. And so that's definitely, when we're talking about selling points, that's certainly a selling point when we're talking with families who prefer to do the trainings and licensing process in Spanish. So even the paperwork and all of that we have as translated documents. And so what the process looks like is first a family will reach out and we'll just talk in general kind of about, you know, how they heard and what they know about foster care already, and always talking from the beginning about that goal of reunification. And then if families are interested, they can go ahead and apply. And once they apply, it takes about 4 weeks for that application to be processed. Some background checks and things are run during that time, references are called. And then after that 4 weeks, the family will be assigned the social worker, who's called a licensing worker. And that's kind of that person that's just the foster family's social worker. So they're really just a support to the foster family throughout the time that they'll be licensed, but they also help them go through that licensing process. So that licensing process typically takes another about 2 to 4 months. And so the licensing worker will come out to the foster family's home on a first home visit, and they'll bring, I'm always very open that it's a pretty big stack of paperwork that they bring on that first home visit, but they sit down with the family and go through every piece of paperwork in there, explain the purpose for it, and then they'll leave that with the family and every couple of weeks kind of go meeting with the family and take the paperwork that the family's finished and then keep going over questions. There will be some interview questions about just like the family's daily routine and things during that time. And then also just helping with preparing the family's home and bedroom for the child, making sure that there's a bed in there, a dresser or a closet where kids can keep their clothes and the different things like that. And then also during that time, foster families will have to do 6 hours of trainings through the state that are held online. So once all of those pieces are together, again, that typically takes about 2 to 4 months after that 4 weeks of the application. Then the family will receive their license. And from the day they receive their license, their home will be on the list to then begin receiving calls for placement. Once a family's licensed, they do have to do 30 hours of continuing education trainings too. The license is good for 2 years. And so those 30 hours just have to be done within those first 2 years, but families will already be receiving calls or caring for kids during that time.
I know you have so much going on. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the podcast, educate us on this issue, and particularly the importance of finding families who identify as Hispanic or Latino to help so many of the children in need. Thank you, Ashley, for being on Open Record.
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much for touching on this topic, and thanks for having us.
All right. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to learn a little bit more about Durante Matthews, his Open Record debut. He's also relatively new now to Fox 6 News, been here a little while, but we're going to talk more about Durante when we come right back. At the very end of your story on the Spanish-speaking foster families or the need for that, you delivered what we call an on-camera tag. So you're doing your stuff at the end, and then there's Durante Matthews speaking in English, and then you delivered a message in fluent Spanish. I didn't know that about you, and I was really impressed and very excited about that. But it also immediately makes me go, I want to know more about Durante mm-hmm. Matthews and your background. So not just why you're fluent in Spanish or how you became fluent in Spanish, but tell us about yourself, where you come from, and how you ended up here at Fox 6 News.
Got you. Okay, so I'm from Chicago. I pretty much lived throughout the city throughout my life. Grew up as a child more on the west side. My friends would hate me for telling them that. And as a kid and a teenager, more on the southeast side of the city. That's what we rep. I went to King College Prep High School, went to Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, Illinois. That's where I got my my degree. And a lot of people don't know that my degree is not in journalism, nor is it in communications. My bachelor's is in foreign languages.
It is. Okay. Yes. All right.
My minor was journalism. Yes.
Okay.
Did all of your fluency just come from that college education?
So a lot of it did, and this is kind of a crazy story with this. So my grandpa is Mexican. I'm Black and Mexican. My mom's half and half. And my grandpa's father, his parents are from Monterrey, Mexico. So he spoke Spanish, but for whatever reason, he never taught his kids Spanish.
Okay.
Therefore, they could never teach us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure.
So I heard it a little bit growing up, but nothing ever stuck. And I ended up learning Spanish all over again in high school and then in college. In college, wow. I actually, studied abroad. I lived in Ecuador.
Oh, wow. Cool. Yeah.
Yes. With a family that didn't speak English. So that kind of forced me.
Yeah. Had to.
You know, it's funny. People, I talk about how I moved around for this job. I moved around from like Iowa to Missouri to Wisconsin.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Not worldly by any means when I hear about living in Ecuador. Yeah. That's fantastic. I also think it's really interesting because in some ways, this story you just did, there probably had to be some personal connection there because you look at kids who have a heritage, but maybe in your case, you didn't grow up learning Spanish. Mm-hmm. And then you come back to it. You have that heritage and that background, that family history, but then you sort of came back to it later on, right?
Yes, actually. And I kind of connected with the story for multiple reasons. One was definitely that Latino connection because I didn't really have that growing up. My grandpa passed away when I was fairly young. And when he passed away, the language and the culture, it all went with him because it was never really passed down. So reconnecting with that definitely drew me to that story, and also the idea of being in the system, because I did not grow up living with my mom and living with my dad. I actually grew up with my grandma, and my grandma adopted me when I was fairly young. So it was actually her name who was on my birth certificate. So both connections on both sides. Yes.
Fascinating. I love learning about people.
And so now you did end up getting into journalism. You said it was a minor in college, right?
Yes. My and I was go back to my grandma. My interest in journalism really clicked just hanging out with my grandma, because I remember always coming home from school and she would be on the couch in the living room watching ABC Channel 7. And it would always be with Linda Yu as the anchor. She's since retired. But I would always come in and I would just sit down and watch the news with her. And that was a little bit of a bonding moment with me and her, and also my first real interest in the news, seeing stories told from my community, not just worldly, but just about where I live, what's going on, how it's affecting people just like me. And I remember seeing Linda on the news, and I was like, this is an Asian woman, but I can see myself in this role. And then after that, yeah, I just I pursued it in high school. There was a program at Columbia College, a very big journalism school in Chicago, called Columbia Links. So when I was in high school, they paired us with journalists in the city as sort of a mentorship. Mm-hmm. And that was my first opportunity to really go out and do stories with someone who's been in that business and gain that mentorship. And then I just carried that along into college where...
What strikes me as I hear this is I think about why I got into television news, and I wish I could say it was for a reason that would really just wow people emotionally. I was looking for a career that I could make a good living at and that I thought I was pretty good at what I was doing. I never really said I wasn't one of those people who as a child, I just knew I had a journalist. I didn't have a press card in my cap. It wasn't something that I knew from a young age. I sort of grew into it and it became a good career. There are other people who get into television specifically, sometimes for the wrong reasons. We've seen plenty of people who've come through this business who just want to be on TV and they want to be seen. But as I hear you talk about the way you saw yourself reflected in some of those people and that gave you inspiration. And then you get into this and you're trying to do stories that you have a connection to that help people. Do you see your sort of calling into this as doing some good for people who've been in places that you've been or that you have a compassion for those who maybe are sometimes underrepresented and underserved?
Absolutely. And one of the things as journalists, you know, a lot of the times we're supposed to take our emotions and ourselves out of the story to do the most unbiased reporting that we can actually do. However, some of the best reporting, some of the best stories come from journalists who have personal connections to that story, because then the passion really shines through and then they really do the best digging and they do the best reporting that they can because they have the personal connection to it. And when I see stories like that or opportunities for stories like that to help someone, where I say I see myself in that situation or I've seen somebody similar, whether a friend or a family member in that situation, and it resonates with me and I feel like I can help somebody in that aspect, yes, though. That definitely is one of the reasons why I like to do that.
So you're one of the newest reporters at Fox 6. So first of all, welcome. Second, so, you know, you're in Peoria and you've got your GA assignments and stuff. So coming to Fox 6, you know, knowing what you know and what you've learned in Peoria and in college and high school and all the way down, what's one of your goals here at Fox 6?
So one of my goals, a personal goal was always to grow, to challenge myself and to do better. Peoria was definitely a great start for me. I was there for 4 years, and I sort of climbed up the ladder pretty quickly there. But I also kind of outgrew the area. And then I get to an area like Milwaukee where it's so much bigger and so much stuff going on that it can actually be intimidating. But when I see all of the, there's a lot of veterans here at the station, for sure. People who've been in the business a lot longer than I have, more experience than I have. And my goal is to learn from them and hopefully in the future, take what they did to me and pass it on to the next generation of up and coming journalists as well.
Do you get a feeling, Sarah, like he is going to go really far?
I love this. Yeah. Yes, no, I really do. So.
I want to go back to this podcast one day and go, you remember Durante?
We know him.
Yeah. Yeah. But do you know what you want? Like, Alda, if you look 20 years down the road and said, what do I want to be doing? Do you know that yet? Or are you letting time figure that out for you?
I'm really letting time figure that out because I have learned early on that I am not clairvoyant. All of my predictions pretty much failed, went out the window. So me saying something in 20 years from now, oh, God, I'll be 50. Hey!
Well, that's the end.
I won't tell you that I am 51, but
You don't look it. You don't look it. Okay.
Oh, same. Same. No. No, you're right. But it time goes quickly, and I didn't know if like you go, okay, one day I want to, you know, anchor at WBBM,
right?
Or one day I want to be, you know, reporting in live war zones, you know, in Afghanistan or whatever.
Yeah.
Or do you not know that?
Definitely not live war zones.
Okay. All right.
Fair. One of the goals for me is really to eventually get back to Chicago, because that's the city where it all started for me. That's my hometown. It's where I grew up. That's where my interest in journalism started. So to be in Chicago, whether it be CBS, ABC, you know, WGN or whatever it is, to make it to where the interest started and to where I grew up and report on the stories in the community that I'm so familiar with, that is for sure a goal for me. I also thought it would be nice to do some sort of bilingual reporting, whether it be with the Telemundo or Univision, or maybe doing reporting abroad, not in war zones, but, you know.
There's a limit to where I want to go. No, we look forward to seeing where this goes, but we're really happy to have you here at Fox News. One thing I want to ask you, though, before we go off the record, because you said something to me when we were talking in my office, and you said, and I just want to explore this real quickly. You said, I'm a pessimist. By nature, I'm a pessimist. And I want to know what you mean by that. I'm curious about this one now. What do you mean when you say I'm a pessimist?
So
you don't seem like a pessimist when I talk to you. That's why I was
thank you. Okay. but I am. So I've always looked at life, like I told you before, with the glass is half empty. And that may be just because a lot of the things that I may have wanted never turned out the way that I wanted it, whether it be as a kid, you know, oh, I want this for Christmas and I never got it. And I never let my parents forget about that.
It's fine.
We'll send them the link.
Yeah.
We'll send them the link.
Or just in high school, you know, not doing well on certain tests or just not getting the job that I wanted out of college. I try to be very realistic, and I know realistically things are not just, you know, flowers and Febreze and all that jazz. So
we're going to retitle this podcast like flowers and Febreze. Febreze.
Yeah.
I was thinking puppies and bunnies, but I like flowers and Febreze much better.
Gotcha. Yes. Yeah, so that's how I know that there things can go well, but I also know things can also go bad. So I expect, how do I say this? Is it I prepare for the worst, but no. I expect the worst, but hope for the best.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, so being a pessimist, you can turn that into a glass is half empty, so there's no point. Why try? You seem to be using it as a motivator to say, right, I'm not going to let anything get me down. I don't expect it to go right, but I'm going to do everything I can to make it go right. Is that fair?
Exactly. So I don't sit and wallow in self-pity, or I don't say, oh, you know, there's no way this is going to work out, so by God, I'm not going to try. You know, I'm always going to put my best foot forward, and if it doesn't turn out the way I expected, I always have the thought that I knew there was a chance that this would not turn out the way I expected, but at least I went for it. And that's kind of my mantra. Even though there's a chance it may not happen, always go for it.
You know what that sounds to me like?
What?
An optimist.
Oh my God.
Hey. That's just me. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go off the record. All right, it is time for us to go off the record. This is the part of the podcast where we get a little more casual, have a little fun. It's all, what was it?
Flowers and Febreze.
We have a little fun by answering a question for which we have not prepared. And of course, Sarah has that question.
I have prepared. My question today, I know on this podcast we've talked about what your thermostat is set at your house, at your apartment, whatever. And we've talked about that and got into it about that. Now I'm going to ask, what is your ideal sleeping temperature?
Oh, yeah. I'm cold. What does that mean?
I don't disagree, but what does that mean, Kale?
I would set it, if I had the control over it, probably at about 67.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Yeah, I think I'm probably there with you on
that. We're at 70 right now. Okay. Constant, but seems I would make it cooler.
Okay.
It's about the same. It kind of changes for me winter or summer, but no matter what, I always end up having a pillow in between my legs.
Yeah, that's not for the temperature. That's for the hips. Yeah, because I am 50. Yeah. 51. So I gotta have that. I know. Yeah. I got that pillow between, but in terms of temperature, I am always the one throwing blankets off because I can't sleep well if I'm too warm. I can sleep. I'll tell you what, there is nothing better than a nice cool satin type sheet or something. And yeah. then if you get cold, sure, you can cover up, but there's only so much you can throw. So if the room is too warm,
yes.
there's only so much you can throw off of you. You can't keep throwing more blankets.
And I also can't sleep without blankets on. So like I have to put a fan on.
Fan.
And then yes. a fan 100%.
Fan sleeper. Fan and then blankets.
Fan for decades. And white noise for days.
I can't sleep with a fan on, but definitely I always have to have a sheet. Not necessarily a blanket,
right,
but a
sheet.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Something over you. Yeah.
But as far as a comfort or a cover, I can't really do it because there's nothing worse for me than waking up just sweating everywhere. Yeah. And same. I will sweat.
Now, I'm not trying to sell a product, but have you guys seen the ads now for those things that are like the machines that will like, you? There's like a tube that, like, pump, yeah. like you're on yeah, your like side the, of the bed, yeah. it pumps air into yours and keeps it uh-huh. cool while the other one's warm. I actually think there, I wonder if there's merit to that.
I would purchase.
I don't see how it could be just one side. There's no way. Well, it's going to blow on both sides.
No, I think the way it's set up, it's a special blanket that has like a divider man. Where you're, you know, so you're going to be separate. You know, there's no like, you know, snuggle up, honey. It's but you're going to be hot. I'm going to be cold. We're going to be happy.
Don't touch
I
me.
Think like, there's that's not the worst idea.
I'm in. Yeah. Think. Let's go.
So my mom was in town visiting over the weekend, and this is back to the overall temperature thing. And she's always liked it really warm. She, you know, she gets cold very That's easily.
How my mom is.
And I said, well, what do you keep the thermostat at? And she said 73.
Oh, my mom keeps it hotter. Every time I really? Go to her house, I'm like, my inheritance is just dwindling away with her utility bill. Every time I come, I'm like down, 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 down. It's at least 75 or 76.
Now, so 73 is really hot. All right. So I know we've done the, what do you keep it at? But when I was in my first marriage, you know, I've talked about it before, I'm remarried, but in my first marriage, my wife would keep it. I'm not kidding, at 59. But that was about saving money.
Well,
so like you can just wear a coat around the house.
Did your fingers and I mean, fall
off? Right.
It wasn't just a coat. I was wearing winter gloves, the thick winter like gloves.
Power went out in the winter.
You can't make the microwave work with those on, so you got to keep taking them off. No, it wasn't.
Oh, well, you might as well just turn it off.
Yeah, right.
Everyone, yes.
Right.
What I realized, this is what was funny about it, is she had it at 59. And I was just doing this story on the landlord last week, right? And I was talking to Department of Neighborhood Services, and we were talking about, you know, places where heat might be off or whatever. And heat is, landlords are required to keep the temperature of the house at 67 or above. Like, so
not even my own.
Was she if she was my landlord at the time, I should have called the building code.
Slumber.
You know?
Wait, one more question about sleeping, not to change the subject again. Do you guys sleep with so there's a fitted sheet and then there's like top sheet. Do you sleep with a sheet or just the
top sheet is one of the worst things that's ever been invented.
What?
It's what are you talking about? Just gets in the way.
No. It's a barrier for it. Between your body and the comforter.
No. I know Durante are on the same premise because if we don't want that heavy blanket, the top sheet becomes the thing you put over.
So exactly.
No.
Do you wash your comforter all the time then?
We will wash it maybe every other week, I think.
That's kind of a pain. It's big.
But do you keep it tucked? Like, are you a tuck or a no tuck on the sheets in the
sheets are tucked.
Right.
If it's on the bed, if it's on the bed, it's untucked when
we get
in. But doesn't
it, like, your feet get squeezed down?
I'm 5'4" and a quarter. I'm not as long as the bed is, so I'm okay.
Yeah, no, I don't. I'm a no tuck.
Doesn't it come all like bunched up?
Well, no. I mean, I guess if you pulled on it a lot this way, but no, it works just fine.
Are you a wow sleeper?
I might be. I do toss and turn a lot. I flip a lot in the middle of the night, and then that knee pillow, you got to flip around.
Yeah,
that.
You know who else does that? Pregnant ladies.
Also,
I don't think that's Brian's issue.
He's 50.
That's just one more thing. Pregnant. That's just one more thing that you have to make. The bed in the morning, then too. It's like, man, this is the worst.
No,
do you sleep comfortably at night? I'm
kidding. Kale, no one's coming to inspect my bed, so I'm not making it.
No, I don't make it either. Just to get into it.
No
one doesn't. Sees it.
I actually feel like that's psychotic to make the bed in the morning.
Is wait, really? Yeah, you guys don't make your bed every morning?
No, that's another question. That could have been.
Can I come and live with you guys?
We'll keep it cooler. Well,
now,
we won't make the bed.
Kale, this is now the question. I think I already know the answer based on what you just said. Did you make your bed every day before Jasmine?
No.
Okay.
Very well.
See? All right. But
we see what happens.
Jasmine seems like somebody who probably keeps a very clean, very neat, orderly home.
Yes.
Beautiful, beautifully decorated.
Do you have extra fancy pillows on your bed?
We have a couple.
Okay.
Who's coming in to see the bedroom Nobody. Now, if guests are coming and they might want to see the house, then yes, I'm going to clean up. But then I've also got to clean up the other stuff that's on the floor, whatever it might be. So
now anyway, guests have no business in my room. I just close the door.
There you go. Don't go in there. It's like a laboratory. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to take one more break. We'll wrap things up when we come right back.
like a laboratory.
Okay, we're back and she is still laughing about it. Is it because what I set up at the laboratory?
Yeah,
I don't know why.
Like I'm thinking, laboratory.
I was thinking like a science experiment. It's what's a method that? In there. You don't, it just.
My bedroom is not like a science experiment.
I meant
let's
to,
wrap it up. We have 40 seconds.
That's the story we're giving people so they don't go in there.
Durante's never coming back, just so you know. Nay.
All right. If you have a topic you would like us to discuss on Open Record or an issue you think we should investigate for Fox 6 News, send us an email to fox6investigators@fox.com. It's nothing but flowers and Febreze around here. As always, thank you to the people who make this podcast possible. That is our executive producer, Sarah Smith, our editor, Dave Machuda, and our chief photographer, Manning the Video Switcher, Kale Zinmi. Durante, thanks for being on.
Ami, gracias.
With that, I'm Brian Polson, and we'll be back next week.